Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. Before I get to my guest, I want to introduce her a little bit just as a teaser. Those of you who wonder if you can do something worthwhile in life on your own, those of you who wonder if one person can make a difference, those of you who wonder if you have to go get the highest degree possible before you can have an impact on making things better, I want you to be aware that all over this world there are really good folks who have figured out how to make a contribution because they care about something. And my guest today is that kind of folks, somebody you need to get to know to see how a person in this modern day and age can go about making a difference, I think in any field, if they want to. Life is like that now, and it's like that more than ever. Because while indeed we are getting submerged under big government and other forces, economic forces, there's the internet. There's the ability to communicate, as I'm doing on my radio show, to untold numbers of folks in a positive way. So that's who we're going to be talking, one of those kind of folks today. I'm really looking forward to it. Before that, you know, hurricanes and storms come in groups, apparently. Well, so do my conferences, and I'm going to a heavy period of time where I'll be talking around the country a bit. This weekend, anybody who wants to go to Myrtle Beach, you can hear me on Saturday. I'm going to be talking at the Adlerian Conference of South Carolina. You can Google the Adlerian Conference of South Carolina, Myrtle Beach. It's a gorgeous setting. All the rooms look out on the water if you want to stay at the hotel. Frank Walton, who's, I think he's the director of the conference, he's my contact and a wonderful man, will be there. I've got friends there. Come be one of my friends. And on Saturday, I'll be doing a couple of presentations. You'll get to hear a bit of me. But the whole conference is worthwhile. So the Adlerian Conference this weekend, 29th, weekend of the 29th, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, gorgeous place. And then, not long after, weekend of October 13th, I'll be talking at the R.D. Lang Conference. Lang is spelled L-I-N-G. Lang was one of the two or three real innovators in psychiatry in the 60s and 70s in particular. And there's a conference honoring his work, Lang in the 21st Century on Staten Island, New York, Wayne College. And yes, your host will be there. So, as I've mentioned earlier, I've been in New York City in a long time. So this is a chance to come hear me, but also to hear about some of the really innovative work in helping people without resort to psychiatric drugs. Lang was not a believer in psychiatric drugs. He wasn't an active opponent like I am. I am, in fact, some of you know, the only psychiatrist in the history of psychiatry who has said, damn the consequences, I'm going to tell the truth about drugs, electroshock, and lobotomy. That's sort of been my task, one of them. Lang didn't do that. Zoss didn't do that. But I'm doing that. And the Langians appreciate that, that I've done that, even though R.D. Lang himself, being a shy kind of a man and non-political in many ways, didn't do that. But he was a brilliant examiner of the human condition, and he saw what other people called schizophrenia and psychosis as a part of the human condition. and had a big influence on me when I was younger. I do think this is a conference you would enjoy the whole of, and I'll be there on the Saturday. So this weekend, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, the Adlerian Society meetings of South Carolina, on October 13th, R.D. Lang, you can Google that at Lang in the 21st Century on Staten Island. Now, my guests, are you there, Laura?
I am.
Hello. Hello. Laura Bowley, B-O-W-L-E-Y.
Right.
It takes a while to figure out who Laura is, because Laura is herself. Laura is doing what appears to me to be a unique intervention into the universe. She is what she calls the face of the Mindset Memory Center. Mindset Memory Center. It's online, and it promotes innovative projects that further her vision. So you can further your vision. Her vision, changing attitudes about dementia. And it was fueled by her experience with her mother's vascular dementia. Now, what is she? Is she a PhD in psychology? Is she a psychiatrist? No, of course, folks like that rarely do anything innovative. She's a writer, editor, graphic web designer, over 25 years experience, though she sounds much younger, as people do who are pursuing their vision. Laura runs a monthly called a Meeting of the Minds webinar about dementia. She's got a lot of stuff online, what she calls the first online memory cafe. Laura also edits I Can, I Will, a website sponsored by Alzheimer's Disease International, and I have no idea what that is. I'd like her to actually explain what that is. She lives with her family in Vancouver, B.C., a gorgeous part of the world. And Laura, hello. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your kind words.
Well, am I right? Are you who I think you are, a person who has followed her vision and found a way?
Yeah, you are. You are. And, you know, I'm sad to say that it took my mother having vascular dementia to finally really find my passion.
Now, you're on a cell phone. You're on a cell phone from Canada?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, there's a little bit of an echo, but I think this is okay. And my marvelous engineer with Giselle will let us know if it's not okay. But I think this sounds pretty good. But that's what that little echo is, folks. She's talking to us in the absence of a landline from her cell from Vancouver. So tell us some more about how you got started, what motivated you, and so on.
Well, you know, I think it goes back to when my mother had vascular dementia, and it was our experience as a family that motivated me to try and do something about trying to make sure initially that families didn't have to go through what we went through, and I'll explain that in a minute. And then secondly, through reading one or two books that came out around the time when my mother was in the last stages of dementia, I started to realize that she was much more of, you know, to say that she was much more of a person sounds terrible to say, but generally in society, we think that a person, especially in the later stages of such types of dementia as Alzheimer's or vascular dementia, that they are losing themselves, that we're losing them, that they're a ghost of their former selves. This is all the sort of language that is being used around people who have dementia. But I realized that there was a lot more of her in there, and what it really took was trying to find ways to communicate with her. So our family's experience, we went through really all the classic kinds of things that families go through, that many families, I won't say all families, because some families have it together a lot better than we did, but we went through denial. My mother was in denial. Nobody talked about her failing memory, the fact that she was giving up hobbies, that she wasn't playing games anymore, that she didn't cook anymore. She gave up her driver's license, which she did voluntarily after driving the wrong way down the street. And but nobody talked about it. Occasionally, we would talk with my sisters, and I would talk with my stepfather about maybe she should go to the doctor or she should be diagnosed, and he couldn't get her to go. But he tricked her into going under the guise of having a physical, and the doctor gave her what's called a mini mental status exam. It's basically 20 questions. What year is it? What year were you born? What month is it now? Anyway, she passed. She passed. I think she got just about every question right. So the doctor said she doesn't have any problems. So that was that. we were like, well, okay, she doesn't remember her grandson's name, but okay. So that was enough for my stepfather to just say, well, you know, there you go then. There's nothing wrong. And they went on with life. And then it took a crisis for us to finally get in gear. She had a stroke, and that wiped out the rest of her short-term memory and a lot of her long-term memory as well. And she was also paralyzed, and she had to go into long-term care and eventually into the memory care unit. But we were in crisis mode when that happened, because we had to really scramble to find a placement for her. And it just wasn't a great place. It was painful because each of us had to say goodbye to her in our own way. And at the time, I was thinking that I had to say goodbye to her, but I was saying goodbye to the version of her that I grew up with, that I knew. And each of us did that without talking about it to each other. And then, because, of course, we weren't dealing with it, my mother wouldn't admit that she had memory problems. She wasn't getting any help at all. So she wasn't on medication. She wasn't, getting any kind of more stimulating environments. She wasn't able to talk about it, which must have just been terrible for her to go through what she was going through and not talk about it to anybody. So these are all things that motivated me to think that there has got to be a better way. I guess because of the work that I do, it's all around communication. So that was sort of where I connected with the issue.
Well, it's a very touching, very moving, very real story. Now, the work you're doing, I don't imagine you're actually making money from this work, are you?
No, none.
You kind of put a little money in here. You put a little money in here and there.
Yeah.
Well, tell me, you know, my wife and I, and even before my wife, you know, basically I set out to try to make a difference too. And God knows I put a lot more money into making a difference than I took out. And if I weren't doing legal work now, I'd be, living on a shoestring. And I think it's so important that people find things that matter to them and make a difference in life, because I think that is maybe one of the most important things in life, to make a difference. Do you agree with me about that? Do you have a sense that this really matters to you and it's making a difference in the quality of your life?
Oh, it does. I really have the sense that I have found my purpose, and what I started out doing 5 years ago is quite a bit different than what I'm doing now. But all along, I just felt like I had found a purpose, and it has added so much to my life. And it's hard to describe how you go about finding your purpose. I think your purpose more happens to you, and you start to see where you can make a difference. And then what also kind of spurs me on too is the idea that people who have dementia still need to have purpose in their lives. In fact, if you're diagnosed with dementia, it's the best time to try and find purpose, either through volunteering or some sort of work or, helping in the community, connecting with family, doing something that brings you purpose, gives you a reason to get up every day.
So you're saying, probably contrary to the common sense or medical approach, that if you've got a diagnosis of dementia, don't go hide in your bedroom. Actually do more in life.
Right. I do. I do say that. Now, that requires a supportive network around you, and including your family, your friends, and society. So, for example, if you would like to volunteer, you need an organization that's willing to take on a person with dementia as a volunteer. Or some people have gotten around that by just not mentioning the fact that they have an issue. So, but people, I've talked to, well, I know one woman who tried to volunteer, and she's been turned down at every place because she has dementia. So even though she has had a professional background. So,
what were some of the steps you went through to begin to do this? What does a person do who's beginning to discover a purpose. And I do think if you're going to choose between the two P's, purposes and pills, you're going to have a lot better life if you choose purposes, folks. Purposes. They make so much the difference in life. And I'd love to hear. I didn't know I was going to want to go in this direction with you, but I just think it's such a good direction to go. And we didn't talk about this on our phone call, pre-phone call. About how this purpose got going. What did you do? What does a person do?
Well, what I did, because as you pointed out, I have a business degree. I don't have a medical degree or a social work degree or anything. And, it has hurt me a bit, and it has been to my advantage, because not having a degree that people who typically work in this field would have has meant that there are jobs that I could not apply for or that I did apply for and didn't get. But that has also pushed me to be more innovative and to go into different directions. So that was one motivator, is to figure out how I could do what I thought was needed with the skills that I had. So that was really my natural fallback. So the first thing that I did is I was a long-distance caregiver, I should point out, because I'm in British Columbia. My mother was in Toronto. So I used to visit every few months and spend 4, 5, 6 days there. And when I came, I started to think about what different games we could play. So I started doing nursery runs with her. One of her caregivers in the home that she was in used to do counting games with her. So we did counting games. We did cards, matching games. I used to do preschool sort of games with her, or I'd adapt. I remember adapting snakes and ladders, that sort of thing. Because, when you visit a family member who's in the later stages of dementia, especially if you're visiting in a long-term care home or a nursing home, it's sometimes really hard to figure out what to do on that visit. The person is usually, one of the symptoms is apathy, and they lack initiative. In fact, they don't just lack initiative, they can't. The part of their brain that would drive initiative is affected, so they really can't take the initiative on anything. So it's up to the person who's visiting to initiate conversation and activity. And that gets to be a little taxing after a while. So one day I was visiting her, and out of desperation, I picked up this coffee table book that was about the town that she lived in, and it was a picture book. And I started going through it with her. And I was, the text was really dry, so I started making up words about the pictures. Oh, look, there's this guy and his wife and a baby, and oh, look, there's kids playing on the playground. And she was really interested, and we went all the way through it, and it was like 50 pages, got to the end, and she said, oh, let's do it again. So we went through it again. So I thought, this is interesting. And then I started kind of testing her out on reading, because she had given up reading. She wasn't even reading magazines, and she didn't like to be read to, because she couldn't take in the information and process it. And it just got to be really frustrating for her and overwhelming. But I noticed that if she got a greeting card, that she could read the text on that, more or less. And what was different about that text is that it was short, and it was easy to digest, and the words were fairly simple. So I thought, okay, well, so she can read, what about if I take pictures, put them together with texts that I think she could read, and maybe put in make up some questions to think about asking her so we could have a conversation about it, and I put that into a book. So I drew upon my graphic design and my writing skills, which is where I naturally went, because that's what I do, and I created a book for her. And I put together 12 photos and wrote a short paragraph, blew the text up so that it was large, I made the sentences short and the words simple. The pictures were photographs, because I didn't think that I would want sketches of something that she would have to interpret. I just wanted a picture that was pretty plain and simple to see exactly what it was, and color photos so that they were bright and appealing. And then at the bottom of the page, I put in some discussion questions for the person who's reading with the other person with Alzheimer's could ask, so that they didn't even have to think about what questions to ask and how to start a conversation about it. So I was able to finish that up just in the draft form and go through it a few times with my mom, and she really enjoyed it. And then a couple months later, she passed away. But I still had this book, and she had enjoyed it, and I tested it out in a couple of other places as well with people, and it was fairly successful. So I adjusted the wording a bit, because when I was reading it through with my mother, I saw the words that she would naturally skip over or have trouble with, so I made a few adjustments. And then I self-published it, because I tend to take what I know how to do, and then I do it. I guess that's what I've applied. So I knew how to do self-publishing. I had a little bit of help on that, but I self-published a book and sold it through my website. And I still have about 100 copies in my bookshelf. But and my intent was to come out with other books, but by that time I started meeting other people in the dementia business, and I started thinking up different other things that maybe I would like to do. So that's
Laura,
how I got started on it.
I'm listening. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to formulate a question, which is like, it strikes me like it's, I don't usually exaggerate, the one of the deepest questions I could ask a person, and it may be occurring to some of the people who are listening. Okay, this woman, your mother, and all the other people with dementia have very little time left, and it's an impaired time. Why do all of this? What's the worth? I want you to sort of look at that, because I think that's like one of the deeper questions in life that we have. What's the worth of all of this? Do you get my question?
What's the worth?
Yeah.
It's a human being. It's a human being. And it's a human being who wants to live, who wants to have purpose, who wants to make a difference, who has needs and desires, who wants to be able to talk, who wants to be able to feel love and to be able to give love. I could walk through the halls where my mother lived and the building where she lived, and there would be, well, I remember one woman in particular who was strapped into her chair, and she couldn't talk, and all she could do was talk in gibberish and reach out, and I would just stop and hold her hand, and she'd talk to me with her eyes, and she'd communicate a lot to me. There's so much humanity inside a person that to not say that helping somebody to live every second of their life to the best that they could live it, to not help somebody do that is a travesty. So that's what drives me. That's a really great question. just you saying that, what's the worth? I was like, I feel like I'm jumping up and down here. What do you mean, what's the worth? Isn't it obvious? It's a human. It's a human being. There's so much going on. If somebody is mute or they've lost their voice or they're deaf, we have made huge strides to try and overcome that disability to be able to communicate. But because somebody has lost that ability because they have a brain disease, we stop. And because it's a terminal brain disease, we stop trying. Well, why should we stop trying? What's the difference? Wait, what is the difference between a person who has dementia and can't do those things and somebody else? You know?
Thank you. Thank you for your answer. And I want people to listen to this answer because, I mean, it really cuts to the heart. What does it mean to be a human being, being with other human beings? And I think it just cuts right to the heart of it. Wow. Okay.
Yeah, I know. That's where I'm at right now. Wow. Okay. All right, next question.
Go ahead, Laura.
No, I just I just see the humanity. Sometimes I saw more humanity in that ward than I saw out on the streets. And there are a population of people, especially in the later stages, that has been largely ignored and mistreated and is continuing to be mistreated. So it makes me want to do something about it. And, you know, strangely enough, the end of the continuum that I'm now working on with dementia is the beginning. It's the early stages. It's people in the early stages. And I guess that's because if I can work with them to help others understand what is going on for them and how that translates into people who are suffering in the end stage, that then perhaps people can start to see the humanity that still exists in people in the end stage. You know, to try and change the stigma of the disease.
You're so incredibly thoughtful about all this. It's a pleasure to hear you talk about it. Have you thought about going back to school? I know you're not 25 years old again anymore.
No, I'm 50. So I've thought about it. You know, the funny thing is, and I'm not bragging. I'm honestly not bragging. I'm not shy about if I need to try and find out information from somebody or get some input. More often than not, I just go and contact them, and I do my own research. And because of that, I've met people and have read things and had conversations and learned so much, and so much of it is really cutting edge, and then formulated my own ideas, that if I were to go back to school and take a master's in, or, you know, I'd have to start off probably with a Bachelor of Science or something, it would be really, really, really frustrating, because then I wouldn't be able to be doing as much of the work that I would want to be doing. I would feel in some cases like, in terms of the dementia studies that I could be teaching in class, I think that I probably would have to go to the United Kingdom or somewhere in Europe and do a master's there or something, because they're a little farther along in what they teach their students about this. So, you know, I'm working with groups of people with dementia where one of the things that we want to do is do a webinar where the people who are diagnosed with the disease can have a conversation with medical students, because doctors really don't learn very much in school about dementia, and that they can learn what it's like from the patient's perspective and do it in an environment that is outside of the doctor's office, so that maybe they'll have the time to listen and to learn to the people with dementia. So, you know, when I'm in the position where at some point I could put together a program that would teach students, I'm not so sure that I want to go and become one of those students myself. Does that kind of make sense?
I was actually hoping it wasn't too stupid a question, because obviously what you're saying is true. But I thought it was a good thing to talk about for people who are thinking about these various things, that you're having all this impact, you know, without going to school, back to school. We're going to take a break in a minute. I'm talking with Laura Bowley, Bowley, Mindset Memory Center. What's the easiest way to find you online?
Well, probably the easiest way is my main website, which is mindsetmemory.com. And from there, you can find the webinar website, which is minds, as in, you know, our brains, minds-meeting.com. And you can contact me through the contact form on there. And I can add you onto the mailing list or whatever you like, and just be in touch. And I love to have conversations with people. So if people just want to email me, we can have a conversation. So
folks, if you're sitting there and you don't have a purpose, open your heart and mind to the truth that if you get an inkling of a purpose, you can begin to explore it. You can begin to do something about it. You can begin to make a contribution in an area that perhaps you never thought you knew enough or had enough connections to go about it. We can make a real difference in this life. We'll go to break now, and when I come back, I'd like Laura Bowley to talk more about what she is accomplishing and to talk more about her views on life. I really am moved by how you've gone about all this, and I think you're sharing yourself is just a really important thing for the folks who listen to this show. All right, we'll go to break. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin again. In telling you at the beginning of the show all about the conferences I'm doing around the country. I forgot to tell you about one that's quite near home. In Utica, New York, next Wednesday, October 2nd, I think I may be messing up here. Hang on a minute. You know, you'd think I'd have my calendar straight. Yeah, it is. It's Wednesday, October 2nd. I'm going to be in Utica, New York. My friend Michael Gilbert is running a conference there on all sorts of approaches to children and family, dealing with trauma, nutrition, mindfulness, critiques of the DSM, ADHD, discussions of drugs, medications. It's quite a group. I'm going to be there. Michael Gilbert will be there. My friend Jennifer Kinsey will be there. It'll be a very stimulating conference. You can get to it on my website by going to down the left-hand side, and you'll see public speeches or public events, and you can find the registration information. It's also a brochure, which doesn't seem to be clicking right now. And it's the Mental Health Conference in Utica, New York, Rethinking Mental Health. Rethinking Mental Health. And it's a full day with a lunch. For more details, you can go to M. Gilbert at iacaf.org. M. Gilbert at iacaf.org. But also my website. So it's another opportunity to get together with me that's coming up in Utica, upstate New York. Who says nothing happens up here? We have a lot of fun up here. It's farm country and a couple of small cities. My guest, Laura. Laura, do you have an idea about how you'd like to begin the second half hour?
Well, I wanted to just say that we were talking about how I got started and what some of my motivators were, and I think you ended off by asking, would I go back to school to get a degree? I started thinking about what it was from my business degree and from the work that came afterwards that has impacted my life, and just so that, you know, people can think about drawing upon their own skills and perhaps changing careers or finding a job or a volunteer opportunity that provides, fulfills their purpose. And my business degree was actually in computer business systems, and we were using punch cards at the start, so you know how long ago that was. But I had a wonderful teacher who taught systems design and analysis, and she taught me how to think. She taught me to think in flowcharts. If then else, you know, if this works, if this happens, then do that, and if that happens, do this. And so that impacted the way I think, in the way that I continue to think, in the way that I continue to work through issues. And the other thing was my first real job, which was as a technical writer. I worked for a wonderful small company called Technology Transfer in Toronto. And the company doesn't exist anymore, but I'm still in touch with the owner. And what was neat about that company is that they also worked with their clients in a very participatory manner. And they taught me how to run workshops and how to work with people in a way that valued their input, valued, respected, and allowed them to give honest input and yet still be able to drive a project forward. So I can, think of an overall direction of where I want to move something and yet still provide a forum for people to have meaningful input into where this is going. And that is something that I have always used and I still use to this day, and it impacts the work that I do greatly. So a very participatory style. Almost everything that I do has that kind of style to it, and I believe in it a lot. So I wanted to say that.
Yeah, that's
great. Those aren't skills that you're going to get in taking a social work degree necessarily. So, yeah.
Well, that's right, unless it's a good degree. And I think some schools, you know, do include these kinds of concepts, but it's going to be peripheral. You're going to have to grab for it and really gobble it up. And probably that people get it from an individual teacher. And it's good to hear you talking about these things. I think it's just so important, folks, you know, just setting aside for a minute, you know, all the ins and outs of mental health that are talked about on this show, to just think about this concept of your purpose in life. I mean, really, that could be every show. Every time I talk for an hour with a guest, I could bring that up. I believe it's that without purpose in life, life doesn't reach its quality, its full quality. And the purpose can have to do with helping other human beings, can have to do with expressing your creativity, and which I believe when it's really good involves communicating with other human beings, that that's a part of what you're trying to do, you're trying to share with other human beings. Whether it's a secular humanistic kind of belief in the value of humanity, which we were just talking about before the end of the first half hour, or whether it's a more spiritual idea that, you know, we are God's creatures, as the Quakers say, that we should greet that of God in each other. Wherever you're coming from, the more you can put meaning into your life, the stronger you'll be, the more safe you'll be from emotional catastrophe, the more able you'll be to recover from it, because you'll be rising to a meaningful existence. And one of the things I love about what Laura Bali is telling us today is that even the most injured among us, with the shortest known lifespan coming up, deserves as much of that as we can help them have. What an incredible thought. What a marvelous idea. What a transformation of thinking about human services that is. I just think it's, well, I've said enough. Laura, I give you the mic. follow up with me on this.
Right. Well, I just wanted to point out something that you said, that a person with the shortest lifespan, it's true that somebody in the later stages of the disease, and I should say I use the words in Alzheimer's disease and dementia somewhat interchangeably. There's a lot of confusion about those terms, and dementia, as you probably know, is an umbrella term for various diseases that affect the brain and among other things, destroy short-term and long-term memory, or I should say impact. But in the end, they're pretty much destroyed, and cause various other symptoms as well that can affect the speech, the ability to communicate. We talked a bit about apathy before. Various other functions of the brain that are affected by the disease, and based on the type of dementia that the person has, various different parts of the brain will be affected first. So, for example, frontal temporal dementia affects the frontal lobe, and a person's behavior may change. Vascular dementia is caused by vascular problems, usually a stroke. Lewy body dementia is sometimes associated with Parkinson's disease, and that type of dementia is marked by hallucinations and not so much by memory loss, from what I understand. And Alzheimer's disease is simply one of those types of dementia. Because we have the Alzheimer's Association and the Alzheimer's Society, that was what was really understood about dementia when those organizations started, and that's why they use that term. But a lot of people who are diagnosed with Alzheimer's sometimes have another form of dementia, or perhaps they have an overlapping diagnosis of various types. So, anyways, all that to say that you said that somebody with a short lifespan in the later stages, you're right, they're probably looking at a lifespan now of maybe a year, 6 months, a year, 2 years. But leading up to that, depending upon the type of dementia that they have and where the brain is impacted and various other factors, I think, as well, they could be looking at a lifespan of 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. yeah, so, you know, I know people who have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's who are still going strong after 15 or 20 years. And I would be remiss to not talk about someone who has really been my mentor, and that is Dr. Richard Taylor, who you may be familiar with, Peter. And he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease or some form of Alzheimer's disease about 10 years ago. Now I think it must be 10 years. And talk about somebody who is living with purpose. He really inspired me as well, because here was a person with a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. And he was still in his, I think he was in his late 50s, maybe early 60s. So he was relatively young when he received his diagnosis, and he still had a lot of life to live. And he started out, after his diagnosis, he lost his driver's license, and he followed the path that many people who are diagnosed follow, and that is to go and sit at home and watch a lot of TV. And his family started to take over various tasks for him, which a lot of families do out of being very well-meaning, but really what they're starting to do is to disable their family member rather than to enable them. They should be finding ways to enable them instead. So he started to sink into his symptoms a little further, but he started to write about it because he had written. He was a very strong writer. He was a psychologist, and he had done a lot of writing, so his natural inclination was to write. So he started to keep a diary or journal, and his brother encouraged him to turn his journal into a book, which he did. And the book is called Alzheimer's from the Inside Out. And I think it's essential reading for anybody who has been recently diagnosed or who has a family member who's been diagnosed, because what he was able to do was to give the world a snapshot of what is going on in the mind of one person who's diagnosed with dementia. And he's very, he says he's just one person. If you meet one person with Alzheimer's, you've met one person with Alzheimer's, because the experience is a little bit different for each person. Because different parts of the brain, our brains are all different, and different parts of the brain are impacted depending on how the disease has affected you. So that really means that there's no, you know, one stumbling block to finding a cure for this disease, I think, or therapies even, is that it affects each person differently. There's no cookie-cutter approach, really, that works. So, yeah, Richard has, we've partnered on a lot of projects, and he and I started the A Meeting of the Minds webinar over a year ago. He then had a bout with esophageal cancer, so he had to take a break for, I think it was about 8 months, but he's back now, and he has spoken all over the world. He's spoken at conferences and at various meetings around the country as well. So, yeah, anybody who's listening who wants to learn more about what the disease is like from the perspective of somebody who has it should pick up his book called Alzheimer's from the Inside Out, which is available on Amazon. And it was really life-changing for me to read that. And then I met him at a conference in Toronto, and that was kind of that. So, and, you know, the other thing that really got me going was not only figuring out how to use the technology to the benefit of people who have the disease, but it was using social media to connect with others in the field. And that was huge for me. I connected with people on LinkedIn who are still friends and colleagues. Richard was one of them. And there's another lady by the name of Kathy Greenblatt, who is a sociologist and a photographer. She's retired, but she published a book last year called Love, Loss, and Laughter, Seeing Dementia Differently. And it's a terrific book. And her goal has been to take photographs of people with dementia from all over the world and showing them in a positive life and how they're living a positive life with purpose, even with the disease, and how they are being assisted in doing so. So it's to counteract all the negative images that we get about dementia. I think probably the goal there is to, if somebody is diagnosed or they have a family member who is diagnosed, is to try and see past all the obvious negative and to think instead about what this person is able to do. How can they still live a productive and purposeful life? And I think that, just as you alluded to, that we as humans, we need to have purpose to drive our life forward. That doesn't stop just because you get a diagnosis of dementia. So I've gone on far too long. I hope you're still there.
Yes, I once in a while, as my listeners know, I just sit back and listen. And this is one of those days where I sit back and listen, because everything you have to say is important for anyone to hear and to listen to. One of the things I've noticed about people who have dementia, which was kind of counterintuitive to me, wasn't what I necessarily expected, you know, as I've been learning about this over decades and decades, is that many people with dementia actually continue to enjoy their lives. And that's not, you know, those of us who are sort of intellectually oriented and thoughtful and value our intellects, which could be anybody listening to a show like this, everybody listening to a show like this, we would think that it's a catastrophe that would throw us into a horrendous depression, and it would be, you know, just impossible to begin losing our faculties. But in fact, it's really not how a lot of people experience it. Could you talk about that with the audience?
Sure. If you receive a diagnosis of dementia, if you're recognizing that you have some issues around short-term memory loss and confusion, and there are various other ways that the symptoms can show themselves, and no, losing your car keys is not, you know, necessarily one of them, so you don't need to worry about that. You need to realize that you could be looking at, depending upon the disease, anywhere from 1 or 2 years, if it happens to be the, now this is where my pronunciation comes in terribly, the Creutzfeldt, Jacob Creutzfeldt, whatever it is, mad cow disease, you know what I mean. And I do know of one person who did have that and died from that, and that was very quick. Not very many people get that. It's very, very rare, so not to worry. But you could definitely be looking at 5, 10, 15, or 20 years with the disease, or sometimes even longer. So you have to think, and with the help of your family, and this is where having an open dialogue with your family really helps, because then they can become your supporters in enabling you to live a full life. You need to get them on board with helping you to do that. Because, you know, you got to ask yourself, well, am I going to sit and watch TV for 20 years, or am I going to do something with my life? You know, a lot of that has to do with what your financial resources are, because for some people it means retiring early, much earlier than they thought, or it means that maybe they thought that they would be, you know, working part-time or something, and they're not able to anymore because executive functions are quite often some of the first things to go, and it's very hard for a person to hold down a job without somebody there to support them in that job. But generally speaking, you need to think about how you're going to live that life. So if you, in your retirement, planned on traveling, then you should by all means continue on with your plans to travel. And some people think, well, or if you can find an organization that will support you in volunteering, some of that work has been done in Australia, connecting with organizations that will encourage and invite people who have dementia in to volunteer.
Laura, let me do one of my few interruptions of today. Usually I do lots. I'd like you to address the quality. You're talking about what people can do and so on, but I recently did have an experience with a friend who died very quickly from one of these very short-lived dementias. And what struck me is that she didn't experience it as the catastrophe it was.
Right.
And she was able to still enjoy the limited ability that she still had left. And it is very striking to me that people can actually enjoy their lives even though their brain is being transformed, that the spirit still shines through, and you can see in dementia sufferers that they're not necessarily suffering in the way that you and I, or certainly I, would anticipate if it ever struck me,
right,
that people find a way, that the human spirit can find a way to have a quality of life that they actually enjoy to the end or almost to the end. And it's that, that's what I want to get across, that they can actually be happy. They can actually have enjoyment, even though you would think they cannot.
Oh, that definitely. Now, you know, I would ask you, the lady that you just spoke about, what was her frame of mind throughout? What was her outlook on life throughout her whole life? Was it very positive, or was she resilient? Was she a person who you would expect to have a positive outlook on life and live life to the fullest no matter what?
She definitely had a positive outlook on life and a very sweet presence about her. And incidentally, I may even be hurrying her to her demise, because I do not believe she's passed yet, but it's expected any moment. And she's somebody I've known casually, but enough to care about, as a really shining spirit. And that spirit has continued to shine during this very rapid decline that she experienced. It's, of course, the people who love her who are doing the suffering.
Mm-hmm. If somebody has that kind of outlook on life, that isn't necessarily going to change because they're diagnosed with dementia. So that's one thing. If a person is more prone to being depressed and have a very negative outlook on life and not, you know what I mean by saying not do a lot of life, do a lot with life, you know, then they probably wouldn't with a diagnosis of dementia either. So what I really want to say is that even earlier on in the diagnosis, I was going to say, as the disease progresses, the person with dementia relies more and more on the people around them to enable them to live the life that they want to live. So, yes, I would say that a person with dementia absolutely is going to be happy and live a full life and have, you know, all the things that you were talking about. But they might also be sad or frustrated, or be aggressive in ways that we feel are not appropriate for a person to be, and which make us uncomfortable. And those could be signs that their needs are not being met. So their happiness depends a lot more on the external factors around them as they progress in the disease. That would be my guess, that even if a person is very positive in their outlook and they are seem to be happy and at peace in that, it still depends an awful lot about the external factors around them and how well their needs are being met. And a lot of that has to do with understanding that when the person who can't communicate in a way that we understand how well they are able to get their needs across. So that happens. What happens when they start to what we would call act out in a way that we feel uncomfortable about or is making the situation not safe for them or for other people? That's where drugs come in, and you and I talked a little bit about that the other day, that are in a lot of cases our first instinct is to use what are called like chemical restraints instead of trying to figure out what exactly it is that is going on for that person. So,
Laura, I've got to interrupt now because we're actually down to our last minute, and I'm so glad you did it minute, bring up the medication. Time has raced by. Mm-hmm. I want to say that, well, first, this is Laura Bowley, Bowley, Mindset Memory Center, living proof that you can create purpose in your life from unexpected and even tragic sources. And this show just has brought out so much the basic truths about life, which is even if your machinery is damaged by disease, you remain a person. You remain a person, and to the extent that you are spiritually positive, that will stay with you and can stay with you. And that, as always, when we're injured, what folks need is love and care and interest and not to be in any way discarded or dehumanized. It's just lovely may not be the word, but it is a lovely model as presented by Laura Bowley, and I think by all the people who work well in the mental health field, about how to treat human beings. Laura, you can take five last words.
Okay.